I've never written a book like this before, and I want to explain why I wrote it, in addition to being a love story for my mom and dad and my sisters and brother. I wrote it because if you are looking for active citizens to help you in making a better country or community, after a while, you run out of exhortations and you ask yourself, how can we get more active citizens? And sometimes you have a demonstration, you have a march, people come, and they connect, or somebody has a tragedy and forms something like Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Or they might come out of the universities, perchance, having some sort of mission, whether in science, engineering, politics, economics, organizing, whatever. But it's never enough. There are never enough active citizens. And if you look at the generation of citizens who are active from the get-go, you go back to the family. You have to recognize in many ways that the family has become a political football. Extreme right-wing people like to espouse family values. We've seen how that's played out. And the family is under great pressure. It's the primordial unit of any society, any culture in the history of the world. And it is under tremendous pressure because of economic pressure, the separation hour after hour from the parents and the children, long commutes. It's under commercial pressure. We're in the first generation of systematic direct commercial marketing to little children, bypassing their parents and undermining parental authority, and getting these children to systematically nag their parents and to be exposed to pretty rotten things like violent programming, violent toys, and junk food, over-medication. The third type of pressure is a low expectation by the society at large, which gives loud lip service to children, you know, children first. But our children are terribly mistreated in our society, and not just child abuse, and not just what juvenile detention centers are like. They're mistreated and they're not even given universal health coverage. They're not given adequate and quality daycare. There's not enough armor on the shoulder. They are exposed to fast food companies that sell them products and lure them into their stores that are going to give them serious illnesses, often while they're children, diabetes, later high blood pressure. They're exposed to the most violent personal programming in the history of the world. Now they're exposed to an opportunity to be interactive and engage in tearing limbs to shreds through these activities of what I call these corporate electronic child molesters. And so it's time to be very self-conscious about families. It's time to tap into traditions when the family was more intact and more together, the extended family, and to derive from each family's background the best insights, wisdom, and experience, and retain it and record it and jot it down and pass it on to the next generation. It's not just that children have never meant to have to reinvent the wheel. It's that they may have difficulty reinventing any wheel. If they spend their childhood 50 hours a week watching screens, computer screens, television screens, video game screens, estranged from nature and their natural surroundings, not having an opportunity to socialize themselves with other human beings, including members of their family, shortening their vocabulary and their attention span. So I'm trying to give a context to this very personal book, because I'd like to see a broadening tradition of putting down family traditions, family by family. The quality of the world is traced to the quality of parental upbringing. There have been enough studies showing that the battered child grows up to be the battering parent. There's enough studies to show where dictators come from. And while there are many other environmental and social factors that shape people's character and personality, it's quite clear that the parental environment is probably the most important. Heraclitus, the ancient philosopher, once said, "Character is destiny." And I would add, personality is decisive. And the development of character and personality comes first and foremost, as Montessori and others have showed us, from the early years in their parental experiences and upbringing. When I ask active citizens, as I always like to, how'd you become active? Sometimes tragedies, sometimes alienation against their parents, if their parents are corporate executives, for example. Sometimes they have a labor union tradition. But more often than not, here are the answers. Why are you active? When I meet these confident, steady, refreshing figures, I like to ask them how they became the people they are, how they developed such drive, such motivation and purpose. Quite often they hesitate, then they smile and respond, "Well, when I was young, my parents, my mother, my father, my teacher, my neighbor, told me, took me, showed me, inspired me." For democracy cannot flourish without putting an arm around the shoulders of the young. That's one of the reasons I wrote this little book. And in so doing, I had to answer that question to reporters and to Senator Bobby Kennedy at the celebrated hearings on GM's detective caper at the U.S. Senate in 1966, when he leaned forward and he said, "Why are you doing this?" This meaning, why have you spent time trying to get cars that are crash-worthy and save lives? I said to him, "You know, if I was engaged in an effort to prevent cruelty to animals, I wouldn't be asked that question. But because I was engaged in trying to prevent cruelty to humans, I'm constantly asked that question." And so was my mother. She would get calls from reporters. "What did he eat? How did you raise him? Was he a rebel from the start? How can you explain what he's doing? He went to Princeton and Harvard Law School. He should be now in a corporate law firm. Instead, he hitchhiked to Washington from Connecticut to get congressional committees interested in investigating the auto companies, which were never then subjected to federal safety standards." Well, she got a little weary of this, and one day a reporter called up and said, "Mrs. Nader, what makes Ralph tick?" And she retorted, "What makes you not tick?" And that's my parents. They didn't think that being an active citizen was a deviation. They thought it was a natural thing to do, that civic activity in the community was an extension of family values. Family values, neighborhood values, community values, national values, world values. And so they were always astonished. And I was astonished because they would take their children to the town meetings. I'll get to the landscape in a moment, but we grew up in a 10,000 people town, a very contentious factory town. and Northwest Connecticut nestled in the Litchfield Hills, a lot of lakes, rivers, streams, meadows, woods. And my parents would take me, and my two sisters and brother, they'd take me to the town meetings. It was a town meeting form of government, and the people were the legislature. You couldn't have a more pristine form of democracy. And there'd be maybe 200 people there in the auditorium, 250 or so, and there'd be like seven people standing up. And it would be often the same seven people, and they would challenge the mayor. And they would have the information, and they would ask questions. And the other people in the audience would look at them like, yeah, go. On the other hand, but they're so officious, you know, they're so pushy. There's a sort of mixed feeling. The next day, walking down our long Main Street, one of the citizens' name was Mr. Franz. You know, people would say, there goes Mr. Franz. And here I'm watching this. It's like there's a town fool, a town drunk, and a town citizen. And instead of someone saying, there goes Mr. Jones, he doesn't give a hoot about the community. In ancient Greece, the word idiot had nothing to do with lack of intelligence. The word idiot meant a person who was apathetic about his or her community and didn't do anything to improve it. One who didn't play out the Athenian code of citizenship, which was, to paraphrase it, I pledged to leave Athens better than I entered it. Well, this town, Winston, was the most contentious town I've ever been in. It was split right down the middle, Republican, Democrat, Red Sox fans, Yankee fans, had two rivers. One was called the Mad River, the other's called the Still River. In 1900, it had 100 small factories and fabrication plants. Show you what towns used to produce in those days. They're almost all gone. The rivers were sewers, chemical sewers for the factories. They dumped dyes in there. They dumped all kinds of heavy metals. And so the town said, well, you know, you can't get much worse. So they dumped the sewage there, untreated. And we never grew up with those rivers. They didn't mean anything to us, any natural splendor. We couldn't wade in them. We couldn't fish in them. We couldn't have lunch on their banks. They were industrial sewers. However, there was other kinds of beauty in the town. And within 20 minutes walk, you had the lakes, the streams, the meadows, the woods, the firehouse, police station, the stores, the schools, the library, the hospital, the doctor, the dentist, the town hall, the railroad station, with seven trains to New York, 120 miles away per day. And that is a great place to grow up in. That kind of accessibility. Wonderful. We walked to school up to a mile through snow drifts. They didn't close the schools when there was a dusting, as they do in Washington, D.C. And we didn't have weather updates every 2 seconds as well. That's the setting. And I start this book not with the 17 traditions, which were 17 ways my mom and dad raised us, but with my connection with certain natural artifacts that I started reflecting on only a few years ago, and was really amazed how important they were to me. First, the giant maple tree in front of my bedroom. It was like a menagerie. Squirrels, birds, howling winds, autumn leaves fluttering to the ground. The snow would cling to the branches and the twigs, and beautiful. And when I got old enough, I climbed the tree and climbed higher and higher in the tree. Then there was the boulder, the 4-foot boulder at the Civil War Monument, which was about 65 feet high, commemorating the soldiers who fought in the Civil War and those who died. And that boulder was a world for me as a little boy. I hugged it. I looked at the insects as they went into the crevices. I flew kites from it. It was a whole world. It was my friend. My mother would give me a sandwich, and I'd run up and sit on it and look at the stars. And there were woods, and there were meadows. There were a lot of wonderful natural surroundings that we communicated with. And years later, I read in the New York Times that there was a program for kids from Harlem to go during the summer and spend a couple weeks with a rural family, and how strange the kids felt. It was the first time in their life that they had put their feet on soil. And they thought it was dirty, because their whole lives was on cement and asphalt. What are we losing when millions of children today look at screens hour after hour after hour? What are we losing? Just because we can't quantify it? I think if we become more self-conscious about this, we'll find out more of what we're losing. Let me just start with some of the traditions. I want to give you a flavor of the family. My parents came to the United States when they were 19 years old. It was a new culture, new language, and they had to learn it, and they learned it in part from their children. They had a tradition of reciprocity. Their children, of course, immediately born here, knew the culture, all the little fads and all the things that were rather strange, and so they taught the parents, and the parents integrated it in terms of their own framework, ethical and advisory framework. And the tradition of reciprocity never left us. Parents taught us, we informed, taught our parents. However, they were obviously a few steps ahead of us. And my mother once very early said to us, if you talk all the time, you're not going to learn anything. So the first tradition is learn to listen. Learn to listen. Something that held me in good stead when I hitchhiked tens and tens of thousands of miles later on and listened to the person behind the wheel who was always an expert in something, a tree surgeon, a builder, whatever. Tradition of learning to listen helped because also when we went to town meetings and we went to gatherings, we weren't restless, we weren't fidgeting, because we'd learned to listen and therefore observed a great deal. We didn't dominate guests and my parents at a dinner table. We were listening. Listening doesn't mean you never talk, obviously. It just means that you think more before you talk. The tradition of the family table, part of it is that we didn't fidget about food. We were told at an early age, you don't know what you want because you don't know enough to know what you want. And my mother said that we'll eat what they eat and they'll eat what we eat. No double standard. And so it was over, but then it wasn't always over. And I would, for example, say, I don't like this. And it'd be a radishes or maybe turnips. I don't like this. And my mother would say, too bad, eat it. And sometimes I'd be emphatic and I'd say, I don't like this. And she'd lean down, look at me, and she'd say, who's I? And I'd say, I? Ralph, I'm your son. No, you said, I don't like this. Who's I? Is I your heart, your kidneys, your lungs? Is I your brain? I'm more puzzled than ever at this point. And she says, I think I know who I is. Because this food is very good for your heart and your lungs and your kidneys and your liver and your brain. I know who I is. I is your tongue, and you're turning it against your brain. Eat up. She said with her dazzling smile. health. How do you get a child to listen to a mother and father about taking care of their health? But when they come down with chickenpox, whooping cough, and measles, they are very attentive. And that's when she gently advised us how to take care of our health. History, tradition of history. We'd run home from school at lunchtime, and she would unveil another chapter in some historical saga. Now, she had a tremendous memory, as did my dad, because they grew up before electricity came to their area in Lebanon. And they had to have a good memory. They had to remember proverbs. They had to remember sagas. They had to remember their family history going back 4 or 5 generations. They had to learn about their community history. They had to learn about when something happened and when something didn't happen. And as a result, we really grew up steeped in history. And they'd have ways to drive it home. They would say, how much would you know about yourself if all you knew was your last 6 months? Well, that made it very personal. And it occurred to me that if my mother was raising little Georgie W. Bush with a tradition of listening and history, we would not be in Iraq today. The tradition of scarcity. They didn't overload us with toys and things and things and things. We wouldn't value them. When the time came for Dad to give me a first base mitt, that lasted for 10 years. He didn't say, well, now it's time for second base mitt or catcher's mitt. And so we tended to develop a tradition of thrift. And during World War II, you know, things were rationed. So we had a victory garden, like a lot of people in our country. And we also put the thermostat down, and we wore a sweater, and we saved on fuel, and gasoline was rationed. So from that came the effort on energy conservation. It just came out very naturally in terms of looking at the enormous waste in our economy, staggering waste of food and fuel and wood and raw materials and you name it. We were rooted in that tradition. It stayed with us. It didn't leave us when we went to college. Our parents never preferred one child over another. There's a tradition of sibling equality, because we all know that it's a devastating impact on a disfavored child that can last a lifetime. I don't know any more predictable, devastating internal household impact other than physical child abuse. Than preferring consistently some children over another. And we would bait my mother to try to get her. You said, well, you know, and try to just, you know, lay a trap for her, you know, like, so, well, clearly my older sister is behaving so much better and is so smarter. She would never, you know, it became a family joke. Another family joke was she'd have a nice birthday cake for us with all kinds of frosting, and we'd blow out the candles, and then with a smile she'd carefully skim off the frosting and off it would go. And this got the attention years later of the Wall Street Journal, who actually devoted an editorial denouncing my mother for her puritanical ways. And of course it was a family joke. And the thing that got the Wall Street Journal, I guess they got tired of slamming me and 50 editorials set to take on my mother, was that she gave us raw chickpeas to chew on the way to school. And that was, for the Wall Street Journal, the final straw. I guess they preferred M&Ms. Then there's a tradition of education and argument. And this was, we used to say we were educated at home and we were instructed in school. We had fairly good teachers as teachers go. But when I came home one day at age 10 and my dad said to me, what'd you do in school today, Ralph? Did you learn how to believe or did you learn how to think? Well, I went up in my room and thought about that one. But then I began recollecting where I was taught to believe, even if it was factually inaccurate. Like, we didn't have a public library. We had a memorial, privately endowed library. And my teacher said, no, it's a public library. And I said, no, it isn't. And she put me in the dunce chair. That's teaching to believe. We had a tradition of discipline, of course, and there are a lot of ways to discipline children. And if we did something out of order, we were told to stand in a corner near the sewing machine, look at the wall, and ponder our misbehavior. And they very rarely said to us, stop it, cut it out, do this, don't do that. They threw proverbs at us, wonderfully appropriate proverbs, which we heard more than once. And because they came from a proverbial tradition. And these proverbs were such pearls of wisdom. After all, they've stood the test of centuries. They had a calming and very disciplining effect on us. My Aunt Edma in Lebanon, she knew over 1,000 proverbs. She talked in proverbs. There wasn't anything we could tell her about human behavior that she didn't have a proverb for. And a while back, I said to myself, I wonder how many proverbs I know out of our culture, English-speaking culture. And I just barely made it to 20, and only because of Ben Franklin. And that, I think that's an impoverishment in our country. I think books have been written on the utility of proverbs, the meaning of proverbs, of course. We can't go into it now, but I think teaching children proverbs is the way to go in between Harry Potter books. The tradition of simple enjoyments, talking about Harry Potter, we had almost no commercial entertainment except going to see Yankee games on the train and one or two movies a year at the Strand Theater. It was gardening, hiking, bicycling, building puzzles, building snow people in the snow, jumping into huge drifts, climbing trees, playing kick the can in the backyard, and arguing. And my father used the most remarkable utopian schemes in order to hone our skills. And one of them was, he always had to wrestle with, what do you do about greed and power in human history? It's an eternal problem. Look at it today, the corporate executives and so on. And he had something he called limitation of wealth. He said, we should have an economic system where you can achieve unlimited income. But if you had over $5 million in wealth, you had to give it away charitably, or it's taxed away. That topic was good for 20 years of arguments. How would they evade it? What if they gave it to the wrong charity? What if this? What if their relatives were involved in the charity? How is it going to be administered? He just loved it. Because it kept us going to ever higher levels of intellectual inquiry as we were grade school, high school, college, and so on. We had a tradition of independent thinking, and this one started in a very memorable way. Third grade, came home, was whining, crying, Mom, I want to wear long pants. The other boys are wearing long pants. Why do you want to wear long pants? Well, it's cold in the winter, and if I fell, I wouldn't scrape my knee. Didn't work. Tried my trump card. Mother, straightened up. Mother, their mothers let them wear long pants. And mother looked at me, smiled, and said, well, Ralph, they have their mothers, and you've got yours. And then the trump card. She said, why are you worried about being a little different? Why are you worried about being a little different? One day, my dad said, jump into the car, Ralph. I'm going to take a tour around Winston. My mother had written an article, How to Tour Your Own Hometown. Because, you know, people live in the hometown. They don't ever visit the factories, the drinking water purification plant, whether lack of curiosity or just keep deferring it. And so we went past the library. And it was private philanthropy. Miss Beardsley, $10,000 donation, 1900. Went up the hill to the first county hospital. Two families donated the money to build it in 1901. Went over to the high school. It was built by an industrialist, the owner of the Gilbert Clock Company in town, which is a world-famous clock at the time. Went by a park, same thing. Philanthropists set it up. Went by the orphanage, a very nice orphanage. It was also local industrialist. Then we stopped by the curb of the house and just was quiet for a few minutes. And he said, you know, there are at least 100 families in this town during this period who are as wealthy or wealthier than these people. Imagine what this town would be like if they did the same thing. That is, they established institutions. And he never let government off the hook in terms of their responsibilities, of course. But he didn't want to let the wealthy off the hook. And he practiced what he preached to the extent of his resources. Always was very charitable. Fed people who were in the Depression, walked into his restaurant. The restaurant was a huge, sprawling place on Main Street opposite textile mills, and hundreds of workers would come, and tourists and civil jurors on a lunch break, and lawyers and doctors and tradespeople and painters and carpenters and teenagers. It was a bustling place of argument, bantering, jokes, ethnic jokes, which today would be, you know, politically incorrect, but they were ethnic jokes in front of each other. The Italians would have ethnic jokes with the Polish Americans, and the Irish would have ethnic jokes with the Jewish Americans. It wasn't suppressed. It was in a way of relieving tensions. And I remember once a dentist who rented the place above my dad's restaurant to my dad, who owned the building. And he was drafted into the army. There were 15 million people in the army then, World War II. They needed dentists. And so he was drafted, he was made a captain. And he came down, he's rather worried about what would happen on his return. My father said, I'm not renting that space. He said, when you come back from the army, you just come by, we'll have a cup of coffee, I'll give you the keys, and you go upstairs and reopen your practice. And, you know, in World War II, you could rent anything just like that. But to him, that was the family value translated to family practice, business practice, rather. He didn't draw a line that way. We didn't draw a line between our civics involvement and our business practice and our family practice. They had disagreements, my parents. They had conflicts, but not in front of us. They thought we wouldn't understand and we'd disrespect them. So they ironed them out privately. I remember being appalled by the totally out, very, very noisy conflicts between mother and father in our town, sometimes spilling out into the street and pots and pans being thrown after them and the children watching and crying, because our parents never did that. They were pretty low-key anyway. They were very involved, but they weren't aggressive about things. There was a tradition of work. We had to do our chores, and sometimes I didn't like to do the chores. I'd rather listen to Mel Allen on WINS, New York Yankees. And it amazed me how fast the grass grew and how fast the leaves fell in the autumn and how fast the snow piled up. But when I heard those steps from my mother heading toward the living room, I knew I had to turn it off, even if it was the ninth inning with the bases loaded and a one-run lead. The tradition of business was a great education for us. We had to meet a lot of people fast in the restaurant. We had to interact with them. We had to read them. And watching my father operate, it was really tough. I mean, a restaurant, he was open 7 days a week. He had bulging veins in his feet and legs because he had to stand so much. You had to worry about food coming on time, the cook showing up, the supplies, the quality. The people came into the restaurant, all kinds of temperaments. Some of them had a bad day and they're very impatient, and coffee had to be fresh, and often the heat didn't work, and the restaurant was destroyed three times by the flood of the Mad River, over flooding its banks and destroying Main Street. But he still had an equanimity to him. He was very upbeat. He hated to regret. And one day, four teenagers were in a booth, and they were misbehaving. And they were pouring pepper into the sugar bowl. You know, you can't use sugar when you have pepper in the sugar bowl. So my father saw this. He walks over, leans on the table, looks them in the eye, and says, "Why are you insulting your parents?" Then he gradually took the bowl away, didn't ask him to leave, just let him think about what they did. So he was very much into deep imprint, not just showing anger and get out of here. Very much into deep imprint. And my mother really tired of the floods. They took lives, they destroyed property. The town always procrastinated, doing anything about it. The solution was clear, it was a dry dam north of the Mad River, so the water would back up. A dry dam is not all that expensive. So she took matters into her own hand. One day she heard that Senator Prescott Bush was coming to town campaigning. He's the grandfather of the president. We have had to observe three generations of Bushes, and there has been a distinct contemplation, a decline in contemplative ability, clearly, over 3 years. To engage in some dramatic understatement about the present commander-in-chief. So she stood in line, and she finally reached him in the receiving line. He was shaking hands, smiling. And she shook his hand, and she said, "Senator Bush, we've got to get a dry dam. You've got influence in Washington. Get the Corps of Engineers to build it." And he was like, "Yeah," like that. You know, next hand, she wouldn't let go. She would not let go. There are 10 people watching this, and he's like going like this. She would not let go until he said, "I'll get you that dry dam." We got a dry dam. We haven't had a flood since. Now, her lesson to us was, about the only time you're going to get close to a politician is to shake the politician's hand. And if you want an answer to your question, don't let go. There's three more traditions. One tradition of patriotism, not what you might think. It was not flag waving. My father could not wait for anybody in a restaurant to question his patriotism. Love it or leave it, go back where you came from. Like it made his day. He'd have responses like this. "You know, Mr. Nader, if you keep talking, spouting off like this, you're going to lose business." He said, "Really? I've already lost business. But when I sailed past the Statue of Liberty in 1912, I took it seriously. Don't you?" And then he turns the table. "By the way, fellas, do you love your country?" "Darn right we do." "Well, then why don't you spend a little more time improving it?" That's the way he dealt with patriotism. It meant improving your community and your country and your people and your neighbors. That's what patriotism, that's what was drilled into us at a very, very young age. And when others threw these symbols at him, the flag, the Star-Spangled Banner, the Pledge of Allegiance, he'd have more of a ball. When they threw the Pledge of Allegiance, "I bet you never said the Pledge of Allegiance." I said, "Really?" He said, "Well, I happen to know the last few words of the Pledge of Allegiance. Do you?" And they'd think a bit, because, you know, they pledged the allegiance at school. And then they didn't want to repeat it. And he forced them to. He says, "What is the Pledge of Allegiance ending?" And they say, "With liberty and justice for all." And he says, "Right. Not liberty and justice for a few. Liberty and justice for all. And who's going to get it if it's not we the people?" They had a look. He loved the restaurant because he loved to talk like that. They'd say, "For a nickel, you got a cup of coffee in Nader's restaurant, 10 minutes of politics." Tradition of solitude. They let us be by ourselves, not over schedule, as today's words have it. So we gazed at the stars and rushed to the meadows and did our puzzles just by ourselves. My mother said to my sister, I'm not going to let you join the high school choir unless you learn how to sing by yourself first. And then you join the choir. She had a great way of teaching us that some things were priceless, a word much abused now by MasterCard. Afternoon, beautiful spring day, backyard, all the children there with the parents. And my mother says, how much is a dozen eggs? What's a loaf of bread cost? What about a pound of butter? 5 pounds of potatoes? And we'd know the answers. We wonder, what's going on here? We're a restaurant family, you know? Why are you asking these questions? She paused and smiled. She said, what's that sunshine worth? Nice cool breeze? How many dollars? Look at those birds singing beautiful songs. What's that cost? And our apple tree, how much did that cost to buy? We got the message after a while. There are certain things that are very valuable that you can't put a price on. And just because you can't put a price on it, just because they're not for sale, that doesn't mean they're not valuable. And later on, I translated this into describing things in our democratic society that should never be for sale that are for sale. Elections should never be for sale. Politicians should never be for sale. Teachers should never be for sale. And childhood should never be for sale. So when people... people say, where did I come from? I had a lucky choice of parents. A lot of children have lucky choice of parents. A lot of parents are very good parents. A lot of parents are too busy to write down and transfer and discuss and be self-conscious about traditions in their family, going back generations. And we have a little website just to get the ball rolling, inviting people to send us their favorite traditions. It's 17traditions.com is the website. And the last tradition, as you might guess, was the tradition of civics. And my mother and father taught us by example. They were on the phone with the newspaper editor. They were at meetings. They were always trying to work on nagging town problems like the lack of parking, which was hurting Main Street business, or the schools needed repair. After the flood, the children of the town didn't have anything to play with. So my mother organized section of the YMCA so they could play there, instead of just have to walk down the stench and the mud and the wreckage of the main street. And my father was always looking at the business. You know, he didn't know it at the time, but he really, in a small way, expressed Alfred North Whitehead's very memorable description years ago when he said, a society is great when business thinks greatly of its function. And I'd just like to end with reading a short passage here at the end of this book. It's a short book. It's the shortest book I ever wrote. And it starts out, children develop their notions of fairness at a very early age. In their innocence, they are often able to imagine a world without poverty, war, or pollution, far more easily than their elders. They have no axe to grind, which gives them a wonderful clarity and optimism. Through their words, deeds, and traditions, my family gave me the gift of believing in such ideals. Their strengths were my metabolism. They propelled me to try to reach as many people as I could and to try to show them that most of our problems had solutions. If only people would give themselves enough time to stand up and be counted, and if only some of us would stand tall and lead. For the people do have the power, but only if they recognize it and then take the time to apply it. That is the biggest if in politics, isn't it? But that is the best reason for trying to make the flowers of democracy bloom. There's an ancient Chinese proverb whose words I carry with me everywhere I go, one that captures the spirit of my parents' legacy. Quote, to know and not to do is not to know. To know and not to do is not to know. End quote. Thank you very much.